I have been given the task to discuss whether the best approach to expand HPV vaccine is to deliver a robust school-based program, and I must argue no. On the one hand, it's clear that school-based vaccination programs can achieve high rates of coverage. Case in point is Dr. Fairley's own Australia. A publicly funded school-based program started in 2007 has achieved an estimated three-dose coverage of 71%. It's remarkable. And HPV-related disease rates have fallen rapidly. And just some data that Dr. Fairley started to show you, as soon as the program was implemented, genital warts presentations began to decline, and now we've got several years into this, and warts are almost disappearing. So elimination really is on the horizon, and I think that's terrific and laudable, and absolutely congratulations for that. Other examples abound. Rwanda has achieved a 93% coverage through school-based vaccination. The UK has even gotten anywhere from 80 to 90% coverage. So it can be done. There's no question about that. But I would argue that successful school-based programs depend on systems in which, firstly, school-based clinics are widely supported, and secondly, publicly financed vaccine is widely available. And that certainly is not representative of much of the world, specifically the United States. So the barriers to successful implementation of school-based programs include financing, not just of the cost of vaccine, but also the administration of the program, which is not inexpensive, the logistics of organizing a school-based program, and the inability to access kids who are not in school, which arguably may be the highest risk. And finally, what we see here in the United States, pushback from the target population, suspicion, concern, and mistrust, not just of vaccines, but also of institutions and systems that impose vaccines on people, particularly in places like schools. Plus, I'd like to point out to Kit that we should really compare apples to apples. You know, Australia, population of 23 million, it's great. You can cover 23 million with school-based programs. How likely are we to be able to do that in a nation of 314 million people? Perhaps the better comparator is metropolitan New York. If you came to me and said the best way to advance vaccine coverage in the New York metropolitan area would be school-based programs, I could go along with that because it's a bounded universe of schools. But a place like the U.S., it's just too big. I just don't think we can do it. We're too heterogeneous. So prior school-based programs have shown really lackluster results for vaccination coverage in the U.S., and I'll show you some data. They achieve limited coverage and limited population-level impact. They're expensive to deliver, monitor, and evaluate, and they're disruptive to daily school routines. So, for example, the venerable New England Journal of Medicine reported on an influenza campaign in four states in 2006, vaccine coverage of only 47%, well short of the 50% coverage that you're talking about needing for herd immunity. A free vaccine program of intranasal flu vaccine in Tennessee only achieved 30% coverage in high school kids and 45% in middle school kids. These are the target populations we're going for. And this is a shot-free vaccine administration. So we're not able, even under the best of circumstances, to achieve really robust school-based coverage in the United States. And even recently, this was just published, thanks to Lori Markowitz for sharing this with me. This is the Denver School the Denver School System targeted 9,500 elementary students for influenza vaccine. They only got 30% of the targeted students vaccinated and only recovered 25% of their vaccine costs. So not only low coverage, but low reimbursement of costs of vaccine and administration, implementation costs. So these are some of the devil is in the details. It's not that school-based clinics can't work. It's that in a country like the United States, you're really throwing money away to push this ahead. Plus, I will point out many Americans just don't like vaccines. We have this sense of American individualism, this autonomy, self-reliance, don't tread on me, mistrust of authority, reigning institutions, and sniping about vaccines from both the right and the left. So you're starting to see things like this in the United States. The anti-vaccine movement that really does have traction, and people are just concerned that their kids are getting too many vaccines. There's concern that if you try to impose this in the schools, it's going to be difficult to do. Plus, our politicians are giving us a little bit of trouble here. And, of course, this is Michelle Bachmann, who ran for president, and in the presidential debate in 2012, she famously said that I had a mother come up to me. She told me that her little daughter took that vaccine, that injection, and she suffered from mental retardation thereafter. So even our leaders are mistrustful of vaccines, and people believe this stuff. So I think we're going to get pushback in school-based clinics. So let me end with this. Is there a better way? Can we achieve? I believe in HPV vaccination. I'm not arguing against it. But is school-based vaccination the way to go? I would say no. Let's follow Denmark's lead. Little Denmark. They have publicly funded vaccine that's provided by general practitioners during routine clinical care. And indeed, they have achieved 85% national coverage for a three-dose series through publicly financed vaccination in healthcare settings. So I would say the United States, looking for a model, Denmark is probably the way to go. The Danes know what's going on. So could we achieve this in the U.S.? Absolutely. All we have to do is to provide publicly funded vaccine and also eliminate missed opportunities. There are a number of opportunities for kids to get these vaccines during routine healthcare visits. And this is data, again, Lori Markowitz shared with me, that was published in MMWR last year. This is actual and potentially achievable vaccination coverage for greater than or equal to one HPV shot if adolescent girls, if missed opportunities were eliminated, and that is a healthcare encounter in which another vaccine was given. It's not to vaccinate when vaccines aren't being given, but if they're there for one shot, add HPV to it, and we could achieve close to 93% coverage through healthcare settings. So are school-based programs the best way to expand HPV coverage? I must argue no. They may work in some settings, but not all settings. They're costly to administer, logistically difficult logistically complex, and likely to achieve limited coverage in a large heterogeneous population such as ours. Lots of money will be spent for limited impact. But my capable opponent has a different viewpoint, and I'm sure we can resolve this amicably. Thank you.
I do wonder if Michelle Bachmann had the vaccine when she was young, listening to some of that. So, I just want to finish with 2 points. The first point is that the evidence is very clear that, on average, school-based programs do provide a higher level of coverage. But you do need to be able to create, in your country, whatever that country is, a robust school-based program. So only the US can know they can create a robust school-based program to answer that question. I do note, though, that you did have a robust school-based program with a hepatitis B vaccine 20 years ago. I think you vaccinated 75% of adolescents through the school-based program. The final comment I'd make is a plea that whatever method is used in whatever country, that you try and get as high a target as you possibly can so that we can ensure the cancer-forming types, but even more importantly, that the men of sex with men have their anal cancers prevented as well. I'd be very interested to hear what the audience thinks about what is possible through a school-based program in their particular country, and whether or not the HPV vaccine school-based program could compare to the HBV school-based program. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, I think my opponent and I are on the same page in terms of the need for HPV coverage. There's no question about that. What I'm arguing is that is school-based the way to go? And it may be in the future. Data presented here at this conference is suggesting that perhaps 2 HPV injections can achieve sustainable protection and that 3 may not be necessary. And maybe in the future, in a country like the United States, when we have robust school-based vaccination programs and clinics, that will be a possibility. But I think at this point in time, school-based will be a non-starter in the United States. I would concede that there are examples where school-based has worked, school-based vaccination. But on balance, we've got ample experience that you're going to run into trouble, and perhaps provider supported vaccination is the way to go. But it may be country-specific, and I will admit that local needs should drive this perspective and the allocation of resources. So we do agree on one thing, that HPV vaccination is important and a very valuable goal, and anything that achieves that will be a benefit to humanity. So thank you.
So I think you did a terrific job, and you win the award for the most amicable debaters, for sure. So why don't we open this up to the audience?
Hi, I'm Anita Barry. I'm director of the Infectious Disease Bureau at the City Health Department in Boston. School-based clinics would not achieve the goal in Boston for a number of reasons. First of all, there is a general mistrust of government, and when we try to convey information to people, their most trusted source of information is their personal health care provider. And that person is going to do a much better job to convince these folks to get immunization. We also have school-based health clinics, but parents have to consent for the students to go to them, and it is a very, very small percent of students in a school who are actually can go to a school-based health center. And finally, we've tried in the schools. We put an enormous amount of effort into getting influenza vaccine into one of the city's exam elite schools, and I don't think we vaccinated 15% of those children. And the problem was we couldn't get consent forms back. We couldn't get consent forms. Thanks.
Yeah, I would say that's my experience as well, and that there's a general mistrust of institutions imposing vaccines. You've got to create demand for this, and I think until we as a nation wrap our arms around this, we're going to be stuck at that 30% coverage rate.
Hi, Nicola Donovan, the Division of Adolescent and School Health here at the CDC. And this is something. This is a question that we're actually getting a lot, and I have to say that our thinking is moving a little bit. I think at first we look at especially the parental consent issues around other vaccines where people want their primary care provider to tell them they need this vaccine and what kind of issues that would be at school. And I think where we're starting to land actually is kind of where you've landed at the national level. You're saying it depends on the country. We're also realizing that delivery of any sexual health service is really going to depend on the local context of a school district who's not really used to delivering any sexual health service. So, for instance, it might not work in Boston, a school-based health center, but we are encouraging other places where there would be a school-based health center to at least consider it. There are going to be some other parental consent issues that have to be considered, like delivering the VIS statement, actually. Our school-based health centers have asked for some guidance on even though they might be able to deliver the vaccine, they need to make sure that the parent has the vaccine information sheet. And when can they deliver that? Can they deliver that at the beginning of the school year, or do they have to deliver it within a certain proximity to the dose? So there's lots of logistical issues that have to be worked out, but I wouldn't say let's completely give it up, because there are some evidence. I think in Denver there was a study that showed that actually young women who got the first dose at a school-based health center were actually more likely to complete dosage. And that might be because some place school-based health centers is actually the primary care provider for those kids.
Stan Vermont Vanderbilt University. 99% of American kids are ages 11 to 13 or in school. Can either of the debaters tell me, or Bradley in particular, can tell me what percent of American 11 to 13-year-olds see a healthcare provider in that sort of two-year period?
Yeah, that's
because I'm dubious that it's anywhere near 99%.
No, you're absolutely right, and thank you. But I will say, number one, that absenteeism is really important on vaccination days. So catch-up programs have to be in place. Those kids may be in school, but they may not be in school, particularly the highest-risk kids in the highest morbidity communities. And secondly, there are increasingly opportunities for vaccination during adolescence for meningococcal vaccine and other tetanus booster at age 16. So there are opportunities for healthcare encounters, sports physicals for young boys, and reproductive health exams for girls. So I think there are provider-based opportunities. And I think the other comment about people seeking the advice from their healthcare provider is the most important motivator in a country such as ours because of some of these concerns we have. Now, and Kit, I don't know, do parents... Do parents have to provide a consent form? And you haven't had any pushback from the general population from that? Okay. So it may be different in different populations.
So just, you know, more than 90% of Australian parents feel very positive about vaccination. And only a very small minority have the same views that we expressed on some of those slides.
So I would just point out that the Australians got the criminals, we got the Puritans. You decide how that came out. Jeannie? Oh, I'm sorry. Gail?
Hi. Gail Burstein from Erie County, New York State. I work in public health. I'm a health commissioner, but I'm also a pediatrician. I also been working in school-based health, which I still currently work in, since the 90s. And so I agree that the U.S. school-based system will not work for HPV, as my colleagues have stated. I'm also, as a pediatrician, I'm also skeptical that delivering the vaccine during primary care to 11, 12-year-olds will work. Unfortunately, many of my pediatric colleagues have very tight anal sphincters around this issue, and they just will not discuss, they make strong recommendations around Tdap and Menactra, as you see from the National Immunization Survey of Teens with high immunization rates, but they say they don't make recommendations at 11, 12-year-olds for HPV vaccine for a variety of reasons. And if we think about the success that we've had with the hepatitis B vaccine, where now we offer it in the newborn period with very high uptake, I suggest that that would actually be the most effective method to increase vaccination rates for young people is to also try to get the delivery in at the newborn period. I know we're not there yet. We don't have the data to submit to the FDA, but I think ultimately that's where we may have to go to improve our immunization rates. Thanks.
So Gail, you would have to vote with me then that you would against school-based approaches, right?
Right.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, I work in schools, but I'm also skeptical of our current delivery method now with pediatricians. And we do have a publicly funded vaccine delivery program with the Vaccine for Children program that provides immunizations free of charge for all kids who are uninsured and underinsured. That would include any type of government-sponsored insurance. So those vaccines are free for that at-risk population.
Jean?
Maybe I'm alone in this, but I can't help but feel that we've surrendered the battle prematurely. It just seems very early in the history, of this vaccine. It's a new vaccine. It was just approved. The data from other countries that have achieved high levels of coverage are stunning. Most people aren't going to hear about that from reading the New York Times. So why hasn't there been an incredible effort to get it out there in media and forum that parents really can relate to? I feel like it's way too early to say we shouldn't do any of these things. And I just don't think that people really know what the power of this vaccine is and how it has already been demonstrated at all. Your average citizen.
So Brad, it looks like Dr. Morazzo is not voting with you. Do you want to respond?
It's hard to argue against that, Jeannie. You're right. I guess, at this point in time, with limited resources, is school-based what we're going to put our money into? And I'm not sure it's ready for prime time. I think we need to do a little bit more advanced work. So I'm not saying it won't work. I'm saying at this moment it's probably not the best way to expand HPV coverage in this country. But I will grant you that if you have the systems in place to do it, you can achieve very, very high levels of coverage.
Hi, I'm Robin Farrell. I'm a nurse practitioner from Auburn, Alabama. I have a couple of comments. U.S., it is going to be very difficult with the school system because of the parents, even in primary care, because I do primary care and I've also done school health. Primary care, a lot like my previous associate just said, there are several providers who are very tight and they don't recommend the vaccine or offer the vaccine, or the way they present it to the parents, the parents deny it or don't want it for their child because they think, oh, if I give it to them, then they're going to become sexually active. I live in the Bible Belt area, so I'm very familiar with that term. But for the school setting, I have also found in my years of experience, if you present the knowledge and you have a trusting relationship with your parents and you give them the facts and the information like they had discussed earlier, why not bring this research that has shown in Australia the elimination and eradication, present that in a knowledge format in, to parents, whether you do it nationwide, locally, community, have some reputable person present it and show what the difference will be. I think then they will be more apt to say yes to an immunization process.
Do you guys want to respond? Dr. Garcia?
Yeah, Patty Garcia. So as a foreigner, I agree with most of the people that were standing here. I think you are thinking that you're losing the fight before studying. I think this is a time in which you should start learning from the countries in the South. Okay? What are we doing that is working? I am a little naive about what are the coverages that you have from vaccines, for other vaccines. But I'm sure that you don't have the kind of coverages that we have in other countries. So I think it's time to see what works, why our parents are really given permission for vaccination. It's because there is a lot of work that you have to do. I don't think the way the system is right now is going to handle it. So there is a need of preparation, communication, awareness, and then go for it. That's the only way you're going to reach those kids that are not going to the doctor. So whatever you do, they're not going to go and they are not going to get vaccinated. So let's share knowledge and let's do it.
Sure. Kathy Hsu, Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Two quick comments. One is, while consideration for school-based vaccination programs is one way to frame the discourse, another way to frame the discourse that has been more successful in terms of raising the bar of the total number of school children who are vaccinated is simply to require it as a school entry. For school entry. So reframing it as that and basing it upon those contexts has succeeded for a number of other vaccines. And I think there are strict dictates in terms of the American Immunization Coalition and how they determine what should be and should not be required for school entry.
Yeah, good luck with that. Rick Perry might be president if that American people had gone along with that. You're talking about requiring an anti-STD vaccine for school entry, and I think that's politically not viable.
I think that's
but it's a great idea. I like the idea of alternative strategies, and I think school-based could be, you know, part of the armamentarium.
We have only time for very, very brief comments or questions for the last two people. I'm sorry. Harlan, you'll be the last.
Dr. Jennifer Smith from the University of North Carolina. We're actually going to be holding a meeting here in Atlanta on the 27th of June to talk about lessons learned around the current vaccine programs for adolescents in schools. I think I agree with Dr. Garcia and some of the other colleagues. I lived in France for a long time and they always say, c'est impossible, the first thing that they say. And I think we need to really say it could be possible. And how could it be possible? By really reexamining nitty-gritty issues like reimbursement and consent issues and how we might be able to think about electronic consent from parents and other novel ways to actually come over some of the structural barriers that we know are all realities. So just a point.
Harlan Robbett, Los Angeles County. Well, my mind is open to there might be different ways to do this that might be more effective in a tactical way, but as for structural prevention, don't we have a history of success and a history of advocacy aiming at larger, higher levels of organization in society? We didn't tell people, we didn't get seatbelts adopted by saying people should talk to their car dealer. You know, we didn't say that people should stop smoking by talking to their convenience store owner. So, taking, you know, a lesson from that, shouldn't we shoot at higher levels of organization, of which the school would be one?
With that, I'd like to thank our debaters who did an excellent job.